Okay, Ramblers, let's get rambling.
Dow where it is now, everybody wants a piece of the market.
Oh my God, that is funny!
I don't remember asking you a thing.
I'm funny how? I mean funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
With all due respect, what the are you talking about?
Oh, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration?
What the so funny about me? Tell me what's funny.
You represent the idiocy of today.
I did not know that.
English, mother! Do you speak it?
Are you listening to me?
How's my shit together?
Nice personality combination. Hostile and intolerant.
So that's it then. No one else really knows anything.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tim Howell. We got Ricky on the board. We have S&P futures down 32. NASDAQ futures down 288. So that's not good. That's almost a full percent. S&P 500 futures tick lower amid tech slump. Wall Street awaits May jobs report. So this is our, well, sort of one of our signature shows of the month. Let Carl go through all those numbers for us. Numbers on Wednesday, ADP showed a lot of people being hired, virtually, I won't say all, but kind of concentrated in the medical area and in the education area, sort of what we've been talking about. We have Professor Kevin.
Good morning, yeah.
Hey, if you made it up to the, if you could hang through that ridiculously boring Cub game last night to the last inning, what happened? I don't know if you made it.
Well, I have to tell you, I only saw the quick pitch highlights this morning because I was at a reunion reception last night. So I was out, you know, seeing a lot of people I haven't seen for a long time.
And how did everybody look?
Old.
Yeah, well, that's some people that you thought weren't in such a good shape to start with look pretty good. Some people that were like the studs look older. It's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'm sure I'd run a whole lot of names by you. I mean, names that I hadn't even thought about in decades. So
really, good for you. Where was the big shindig?
Our class had the ballroom in the Duncan building, which is one of those bolt-ons to the stadium.
Okay.
So very, you know, it's a nice setup. Lots of tables, lots of space. They served hors d'oeuvres, a meal, drinks. It's funny because I really haven't had anything to drink in alcoholic in a year or so, probably a little bit more than that. So I did grab a glass of wine on the way in, and half of it was still there at 10:30 when I left.
Well, good for you with that. For those that don't know, these are add-on. If you want to be cynical, which the Irish spent a boatload of money essentially on skyboxes, and they couldn't just do that. So they had to put all this other stuff there to kind of, which is actually very nice, and supposedly some stuff for students and everything else, but by and large it was skyboxes.
It's a really nice student center there. Yeah, I hung out there for a while yesterday afternoon, just checking into some work stuff. So it's a really good setup, but yeah, they spent about $400 million on stadium expansion. About half of it was probably dedicated to non-football stuff, non-football stadium stuff. And it's good, but it's, of course, it's how you justify sinking that kind of dough into your athletics program by sinking half of it into other stuff that you could justify as academic. So, yeah, you could be a little cynical and look at it that way.
Well, you could even go a little further on a cynic road. And the Irish, the stadium was essentially a smaller version of the University of Michigan stadium, right? Same pitch, same everything, but was not as big. So it topped out at, what was the number? 59.075 or something, Kevin, for years and years and years?
75 was the weekly number, yeah.
And so then they said, okay, we're going to build essentially rows on top of it. So they built the structure around it, and very nicely done, by the way. And what'd they go up, another 20 rows maybe?
They got up over 80, and now the third round of it, they actually scaled back to 79 something, roughly 80. But they put better suites up there.
So they had zero suites in the first go around. It was just
they had some, but yeah.
Well, they made the press box bigger, so I guess there were a couple stuck up there. But it was not, And I think that somebody somewhere who's in charge of, you know, dollar ND, the next year or two is they didn't want to be the first, because this is a long time ago. They really didn't want to be the first to do the skyboxes in college, I think, was the motive. And then the next year or two, he had his massive stadium expansion all over the country. And I'm going to say Texas A&M, Ohio State, even Michigan, you name it, Penn State, spent fortunes and fortunes on stadiums. And as soon as one guy put the skybox in, they were in. The Irish were sitting there going, why did we wait a year? So finally, they went and did it. On the one side, they allegedly expanded the press box and put all the stuff in Kevin's talking about. And then all of a sudden, the next year, 2 years later, I went for my reunion. I hadn't been there in a while. They're on the other side, too. So, you know,
that was always the plan as part of that expansion, was to hit both sides of the stadium. But it looks a little funny on the outside. It looks like they they just built these buildings that bumped up against the stadium, and they just got out the nuts and bolts, screwed it together.
Yeah, well, pretty much. Well, you ever see the iteration of, I know it's Penn State, I think it might be Texas A&M, and where they started like 40 years ago and where they are now. And it's exactly like that, Kevin. You know, in 1984, they put an upper deck in this one spot. And in 1989, they put, and all of a sudden you've got this massive thing, and you don't realize it's all just, it's like putting the Lincoln Logs together, right? And they never moved the location. They never built a new place. They just kept adding on. I mean, even Ohio State was, what, 80-something. Now it's 102.
I've been to a lot of colleges like that. And that includes Tennessee.
With
a lot of add-ons. Carl may have been there. Carl, you've been to Tennessee, the University of Tennessee, for a game?
Well, not for the Bananas. I haven't gone for an actual Vols game. But I have been in Neyland, yes.
Oh, okay. Yes, so you get the idea. But that's, you know, it's a nice location. I get why they wouldn't want to just, you know, go build one someplace else. That's right on the Tennessee River. It's a good location for.
It's a goat rodeo in terms of what it does to traffic. But then again, putting 100,000 plus people in one place tends to do that.
Yes. Yeah. Just for today.
One thing nice about the one at Ohio State.
Some of them might stay for the weekend, but 100,000 today, and that's, you know, you get the same thing here in South Bend. You're going to bring 80,000 people in for one day. And they're pretty good at it. You know, they do a reasonably good job of managing the traffic, and you know, they know their drill. But it still is going to overwhelm the system. There are so many, so many hotels in the area that live around university events, whether it's football weekends, junior parents weekend, which is a big deal, graduation and all that. So, you know, they try to break even the rest of the year. And then the big events, the big concerts that they've been having, all that kind of stuff, then that's when they actually make their money. So, and I'm sure every you know, a major conference college town is like that.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they love to have these student camps. And one of my buddies, Dan Paul, his kid is a baseball guy, and they went to a Notre Dame camp and said there had to be like 3,000 kids there or something. Every 15-year-old baseball wannabe in the country was there. It's a big deal. Like you're saying, is all these different things.
And you know, it's baseball camps, it's hockey camps, it's basketball camps, it's all of the above. And in fact, when they built the hockey arena, and you know, for those within driving distance, I do recommend catching a hockey game at Notre Dame. You can see all of your favorite Midwestern teams because they're in the Big Ten for hockey. The arena has all the amenities of a brand new professional arena that only holds about 5,000 people. So everybody's, you know, so it's very intimate. It's a great place to see a game. But the lead donor for that, it also has part of the building is that there's an auxiliary rink. It's closer to being your town's, you know, public skating rink than it is to being a second arena, but that's intentional, and it's, you know, it's still nice, and it's still a nice setup. But the lead donor on that, the Compton family, who are the people who own the Mighty Ducks in California, said, "We'll donate you more money if you put the second sheet of ice there, because that's going to make the building a revenue generator, more of a revenue generator for you, because you'll be able to do all kinds of camps, leagues, tournaments, all that kind of stuff that you won't be able to do if you just have the regular arena." So
you know what they have, Carl? And as I was thinking of you when I was thinking of this, if I went to a game there and they were playing somebody, must have been like Michigan, so it was full, and I got standing room, and I'm going, "Oh, what the bleep." The standing room is terrific. The standing room is like a row, a big counter behind the last seat, and there's a number, so you actually have a standing room spot for yourself, and you can go stand there, and it's just the right height to like lean on, and just the right height to put your hot dog and your beer on. It's better than a seat. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, except that you may get tired of standing. But
well, but I mean, if you're leaning on something to lean on and so forth, it's not horrible. I mean,
it's a box seat view.
Yeah, but it's certainly not, you know, your regular standing room where you're stuck in a corner looking over somebody's head at all. I mean, it's a real spot.
Yeah, they've got like Neyland's got like a rail that is sort of like that. They didn't do a bad job there. I mean, there have been some renovations fairly recently done at Neyland, and there's talk about doing even more and basically stacking, you know, doing another stack level on it, if you will. I don't know about that one.
$1,000 in there, Carl.
Kevin, I don't know about that one. There's already the upper deck is already the nosebleed section, right? Yeah. I mean, the pitch is high enough there. If you fell off there, oh boy.
Yeah, you reach the point where you can't even see it.
Climbing hook with you.
Well, I did not the last convention, the first Democratic convention that was at United Center. Boy, was that an eye opener! I went with the people from the CBOE and our Tommy Boggs, our lobbyist, Patton Boggs and Blow was the term, and he's the son of Hale Boggs, so of course he was pretty connected. And his sister took a different name; she was Cokie Roberts, and Tommy was a pretty engaging guy. But we went there, and we had the conventions are something if you've never been to one, it's incredible. All the areas downstairs they're all, you know, sectioned off with, like, you know, not nothing crazy, just drapes and so forth. Every lobbyist firm, every big law firm is piling people with drinks and stuff, and have a reception. And the regular, I don't know, I guess I'll use the term schmucks, the delegates are just regular stiffs walking around in like regular clothes and like, you know, not suits and ties. And they're, you know, there's upstairs, there'll be like 50 people sitting in a section drinking beers, and they're the delegates from like Iowa. it's like going to a ball game where there's some people in the skyboxes and some people sitting in the bleachers. Regular delegates are not highbrows, especially from some of these other states. So we went to about four of these things. So finally, we got to go up to the skybox. Well, the United Center had just opened, and this is late 90s. So we went up to the third level skybox. I'm sitting there going, "Good Lord, you can't even." If somebody's playing hockey, I don't see how I even see the puck. I mean, you're way the hell up there. And Hillary was giving the speech. This must have been when Obama ran, I guess. But she's giving the speech, and you could hear her quicker on the TV than you could from the floor. That's how long it took the sound to get up there. So, yeah, you get these nosebleed seats. You're sitting up there, and you're like, what am I doing here? In some places, but I think the most bizarre patchwork one I saw was Penn State. That has to be like a six construction. I think it started at like 20,000 people. Now where is it, Kevin? 105 or something? It's up there.
Yeah,
and it's really hard to get to, isn't it? Isn't like State College like one of the you can't fly there, you can't drive there. I mean,
I've driven in there. It's in an oddball location. It's not. It is not an easy place to go, and certainly flying in, not much of an airport there.
What the hell would I ask? Well, we have Kevin, which we haven't for a while. Carly, we've been, you know, it's not like we're telling people to sell the market. We're just pointing out all the different issues there are, and Carl's been helping us out with this with some of the banking issues. And then yesterday, I sent you that thing we'll talk later about, actually one of Andrew's friends or acquaintances wrote something talking about how the valuation of this new SpaceX and how a couple other firms, you know, you look at any of the valuation, it's not just valuation, it's almost like it's some kind of a game. Like it's not even a legitimate legitimate 10K that they're coming out with. Not 10K, what do you call the thing, the prospectus. And I just was thinking on the way in about how hard it is to change people's opinion, even when it looks like, I won't say the storm is coming, but a change is coming. And I hearken back, and I was doing this before kind of you guys were. When I started the business, I can't remember, it was December of 80 or January 81, somewhere in there, a long time ago. And the market had been getting its ass kicked since 1967, 68, when we went off the BOS of A went off the gold standard and started putting money into the system for to pay for the Vietnam War, which, you know, was getting pretty expensive. It was kind of a Nixon thing, but I don't think anybody argued with him. It wasn't like the Democrats were all against it. Of course, the parties were different then. Everybody was more moderate, but that's another story. So, but for really 14 years, the market went nowhere. And the interest rates kept going up and up and up. And so finally, they got to like, CD rates got to like 16%, 15.5% might have been the top. This is right about when I started. Well, it was pretty much so obvious then. Now, of course, people then, with the inflation rate that high, were actually getting that money in the bank. So it wasn't like if the inflation rate was 12, you were getting 15 at the bank. So if you had money, cash money, you never got hurt, essentially, in a CD or even in a T-bill. Unlike this time, which is stuff Carl and I and Kevin talk about a lot. But the when it looked to me, just coming in, like fresh out of whatever, that, boy, oh boy, this can't even really, we can't go up much higher on these rates. And the companies that were around had somehow weathered all that storm and were paying dividends of like 10% just to keep their stock afloat. And it was pretty obvious to me that there was only one direction here to go. And, of course, you know, I opened my account with 10 grand in it, and I was trading on the trading floor, so there's not a lot of money there. But I was pretty much long for 18 months, never made a dime. And actually, in the 18 months between the time I started in August of 82, which is when the rally started, the interest rates had gone, CD rates had gone from 15.5 to 12.5. So it already was happening that the rates were going down, and you looked at the market, and it just couldn't go anywhere. In fact, in that 18 months, as the interest rates started coming down, the Dow was down another 20%, even after the light had flipped from red to green. It didn't even matter, because people were so locked into the fact that this will never go up. I mean, it's been 15 years, and all we do is lose money. And you had Joe Granville, who was the sage of the time. He's like the mirror image of Tom Lee on CNBC. That every day you put the guy out there, it's, you know, we're bullish, we're doing this. And he's right, because the money supply is going in all the time. But Joe Granville, every day, he would start out, he would give out a technical report. On top of the page, in big letters, was sell all stocks. Even after it became pretty obvious. Now, the question is, if you'd have gone to a party, take a guy like Carl. If he'd have gone to a party, got his best scotch, had his pinky up in the air, and said something about, you know, I'm going to go cash in my CD at 15%, and I'm going to try and find my mutual fund salesman. He's probably painting houses now. And I'm going to put some money in the mutual funds. You would immediately gotten cut off, Carl, and if you said it again, probably a straitjacket would have appeared and you'd have been out the front door. The thought of you even saying something like that was 10 times worse than it is now when you and I say, boy, oh boy, there's some wolves in these woods here. Doesn't mean sell today, doesn't mean any of that stuff, because I've seen this happen. You know, where some of the, you know, the signs are right popping out of the roadway next to you, and yet it's months, years before anything happens. And I think sort of the same thing is happening again. I really do.
Well, it is, but then again, the one of the things that happens with this, though, Chief, and for example, just as a more recent example, okay, in 2009, when the market actually turned, I missed the significance of this, which in hindsight's always 20/20, right? You can always find the reason if you look back far enough, and you're honest with yourself about it, which a lot of people in this game are not, in life generally are not. The event that turned the market was during a congressional hearing, and I watched it live, when they had FASB in the Financial Services Committee, and they had the guys there, and they said, you're going to let these people mark their assets at whatever they want to, essentially. You're not going to force them to mark them at today's price. You're going to allow them to mark them at whatever they believe they might be in the future. And the guy from FASB, you know, these guys are your prototypical horn-rimmed glasses accountants and actuaries, right? I mean, because that's their job. Hello. Looked at them and said, you guys are out of your effing mind. And, a little bit more politely, but that's what they said. And the people in the room, the Congress people in the room said, well, you have two choices. You can either do that or we're going to legislate it.
Yeah, well.
And literally that day, the market bottomed. Literally that day. And so what you were told that day is that fraud was made legal, quite literally. Okay, now, if you take a look at what has happened since, the expansion of this is so far into the realm of outrage, and yet not a single person has lifted a finger to do anything about it.
They won't until we crash.
But Disney, Disney infamously started this entire train your replacement full of Jeets and then get out. Okay, they were the large corporation that started this. It was blatantly illegal when they did it. They took their entire IT department, brought in a whole shit ton of Indian nationals on H-1Bs, and told the people that were there that if you want any severance whatsoever, you must train these people. And you can say no, but then you get no severance, and you're fired down. So take your pick, either get some severance and train your replacement, knowing that it's going to be your replacement, knowing that you're fired in 6 months, or get the F out right now, and that's that.
Well, you also have, I mean,
Now, hold on a minute. Now, Disney got away with this, okay, even though this is a felony. It is a wild-eyed felony to do this sort of thing, because it is false swearing. It is essentially the same thing as perjury, which is a criminal act, and you have to swear on these applications when you file for these things as a corporation that you have made a diligent search for Americans for this position and you can't find them. All right?
That kind of stuff.
Nobody prosecutes anyone, okay?
No. Now,
in the years since, when Disney did this, in the years since, if you take a look at all of the larger technically related firms that employ people in Silicon Valley, all of them.
Yeah, once you pick up the trick, everybody does it.
Well, not only that, these firms overwhelmingly now have Indian national CEOs. So not only are they doing it at the line level, they've institutionalized the practice.
Well, Kevin, what do you think about that?
You have two-thirds of the people, Chief, doing IT-related, STEM-related work in Silicon Valley that are not Americans. They're not American-born.
That's somewhat
bizarre. Only that, you want a worse number.
Well, yeah,
effectively, all of the jobs, and by the way, the BLS data, this is from the BLS, this isn't from Carl, okay, this is the BLS data. Over the last, since the pandemic, none of the hiring has been American-born.
That's really something. Kevin, what do you make of just the mentality of the idea that we're going to come up with this SpaceX IPO? And we'll talk about some of it while you're here. And it looks like, you know, obviously SpaceX, the idea of the little satellites where people can get internet around the world is pretty fascinating to me. But it seems to be, according to this article and what Carl's been saying, there's all kinds of other stuff that's thrown in here.
Yeah.
But also, is you're talking about a manager, and just from the investment side, you're talking about a manager being Musk, that no matter what he does, and whether he gets stuff from the government or he doesn't, it's all him. I mean, he will pay
himself. He can't be fired.
But he'll be paying himself $1 trillion before you get dividend one. So.
Oh, it's worse than that.
Well, but I'm saying, which, as an investor, okay, and I mean, if I was going to lecture, which I used to do, I was going to lecture a group and say, and Kevin O'Neill's sitting there, Kevin raises his hand, he says, well, how the hell do I get my money out? I go, well, Kevin, it's now indicative of, on you. When somebody pays a dividend, okay, the mechanics of it is, stock's worth $100, they make $5, they send out a check for $3, and now the stock opens up at 102, assuming it went to 105, because they're essentially giving you a chunk of the profits, so obviously it's not in the company anymore, correct? Well, now you don't see that because all your people up top have stock options, so you're never going to pay a dividend. I mean, talk about if you walked into a boardroom. I mean, some places pay a dividend forever, so they always have to. But basically, new places don't want to do it. And the reason why is because everybody up top has stock. I mean, if you walked into one of the Tesla and said, when everybody's got stock options, and we should pay a big dividend, boy, you might have thrown a stink bomb against the wall, for God's sake. I mean, it's they'd look at you and who is this idiot? But I guess in terms of this sorts of stuff, how do people break? I mean, my uncle used to say, Uncle Danny is a character. I go, well, Danny, you know, you got all your money in the bank. This market looks like it might go up. Why don't you like do a little bit? And the line from the blue collar people, I bought Northern Tissue toilet paper in 29. I got wiped out. Oh, okay, that was the joke, right? And but I mean, how do you? I mean, right now, every single if you walk into any bar you go into and say, what do you think? Well, it looks like there's something weird going on with the market. That's okay. The Fed always says it. But which you know what? If you've been in the market for 25 years, there's nothing wrong with that statement. They make that 28 years. Long-term capital could have been a fiasco. It wasn't, right? They told those guys when they were going to lower the discount rate, they buried everybody in the OEX pit on a Friday morning expiration. And then all of a sudden, we had COVID. The market went up. The Iran war. The market's up, for God's sake. During a war, no matter how you think it's going to end or whether it was a good idea or not, it's a war. It's not a positive thing for anybody here, yet we're up. I mean, every single crisis, we're up. So you have taught a population, unlike during the 70s, that no matter what happens, as bad as it gets, not only don't ever sell anything, but go buy more. And I don't. That may go for another 30 years, Kevin and Carl, but I don't see it going forever, do you?
Well, I don't see it going for another 30 years.
But right now, if you're on a 20-year investment plan, why would you ever do anything different?
You know what? Here's the conundrum, and here's the paradox, Chief. In all of those names, okay, you know, you guys, your thing is, is protecting positions,
yep.
Right? That's your thing, okay? I took a look at, some of these names that have been doing this kind of thing. I'm like, I kind of think that. Playing the put side of this table might be kind of an interesting thing to do, given where everything is, right? And so I go take a look at the implieds, and they're nuts.
Yep.
All right, they're flat out nuts. Which if I'm selling them, I like a great deal. Of course, being naked short any kind of an option position is asking to get run over by a steamroller.
Well,
and eventually you will.
Yep.
You'll get away with it for quite a while, but eventually you're not going to get away with it. And when it happens, it's going to be really bad. So, yeah, that's not exactly one of the strategies that
if you have the cash in there to buy puts, then it's not naked. It's called a cash secure put. But still, you might end up buying a stock at a price you really don't want it.
Well, and you know what? During the crash, during the 08 crash, I shorted naked a very sizable number of GE puts intentionally. And actually, it was large enough that I got a call from the brokerage about 2 minutes after I put the tray on. And the guy's like, "Do you realize that you could get a sign down there?" Yes, I kind of would like to get a sign because then I get the premium plus I want the stock at that price. And they're like, "Oh, okay, as long as you know what you're doing." Yeah, I know what I'm doing.
Well, not to get too technical, in the 2008 fiasco, the insurance companies, I don't know, Kevin, if you remember, the insurance companies were, because of what happened to, what was the guy, what was the big insurance company that had the big deal, AIG? Insurance companies were absolutely getting their ass kicked. We're talking, I think Allstate and a couple others were trading like $8 or $7 or something. And I think I wanted to buy for clients, and this is a strategy, by the way. It's a legitimate strategy. If you wanted to buy 1,000 shares of IBM, say at, it's $298. Call it $300. And so that's $300,000. What you might do is you might have, depending on who you are and your station in life and so forth, you might have a broker that says, you know what, why don't we buy 500 at 300? Let's sell the 310 calls and sell the 285 puts or something for, let's say, $9 or whatever the number is. I'm just pulling them off the top of my head. Well, now the second 500, if you have to buy it, you're buying it at 276.
Right.
So you're essentially, it doesn't help you if it goes to 100. You know, it helps you a little bit, but
it doesn't help you much.
Well, yeah, it doesn't help. Well, if you can do it 3 months in a row and your money you're taking in is now up to 50, over time it can become a risk control device. But the first day it's sort of not. So I bought this all. I think it was Allstate. It's $7 instead of buying for like three clients. Instead of buying 4,000 shares, I bought 2,000.
Yeah,
and I sold the 5 puts in the 10 calls. My price for the second batch, should I have had to buy it, was like -2. the calls and puts were so expensive. I sold the straddle for like $9. I bought the stock for $7. So if I had to buy the other 2,000 shares, I'd have bought it at -2. Of course, what do you think?
That was essentially, I mean, the game that I was playing with GE was essentially the same thing, right? I was like, well, now, of course, the possibility did exist that the company was going to go zero.
Yeah, right?
But I didn't. I mean, I rated the possibility. You know, if that had happened, I would have lost money.
So, Kevin, guess what happened? My genius move.
What happened?
Stack went right to 20. So I'd have been much better off just buying all 4,000 shares at $7.
Well, yeah.
If I locked myself in at 10.
Yeah, well, in my case, what ended up happening?
Well, 10 plus the 9, but go ahead.
They never actually hit the strike, okay? So I just pocketed the premium.
Right. Okay.
I didn't get assigned, but I was trying to get assigned.
Yeah, this thing blew to the upside so fast. I'm sitting there. Why did I do that?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. And then of course it reversed and went hard up, and I'm like, oh crap! I just should have bought the stock.
Well, you really can't be too pissed, and that's one thing.
I wasn't, because I made a profit on the trade.
Well, that's what my guys on the trading floor were always, they used to call it, there was a hand signal. And if guys were, you know, if somebody were to, everybody cared if somebody lost money, right? Because, you know, it was kind of a camaraderie. So if somebody had a bad day, you cared about it. But one thing you didn't want is for somebody who said, we had a $2,000 day and was bitching, but they didn't have $3,000.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, there's only so much you can complain you put your hand backwards and run it up and down the side of your face. They call it sniveling. Those were the tears coming down. Stop sniveling. I don't know if you ever heard that. If you ever saw that gesture, Kevin, but it's pretty cool, actually.
The thing that I think is so interesting, and I wrote some stuff about the SpaceX
thing.
It's the leaks, okay, as opposed to the actual thing that's been filed now. So I knew about some of the hair, but not all of it. And the amount of insanity. Now, that, I fully expect this thing will completely subscribe. And they'll, I mean, good God, I'm getting solicitations from mainline brokerages do my indication of interest.
Did Musk do the full deal, and he's got the full registered he's not big on this kind of stuff. Does he have the full registered prospectus and the red herring and all that stuff?
It's out there now, apparently, yeah. So, I mean, it's, but like, you know, if you go on Schwab, you can actually, you know, set up your indication of interest. And it's non-binding until the day comes, right? Then you have to confirm. And you may or may not get the allocation. You know, it's the usual BS. You may or may not get the allocation you want and, you know, whatever have you, which is fine. But it is what it is essentially, and the thing that I think though is so fascinating about this though is that out of all the different things that he's got rolled up in this thing, exactly one of them, just one, actually makes money.
Yeah, that's right. The rest of them. Right,
Kevin, the rest of them are actual break even or losers.
Kevin, if your old buddy Tom Howell calls you up and says, "Hey, guess what? I can get you 3,000 shares of SpaceX." What's your reaction?
Good for you.
I mean, are you going to write the check?
No.
Why not? I got it for you. Everybody wants it.
Everybody wants it. Yeah, man. I'm a
There's the problem.
I'm gonna say if it got down to me or you. There's a problem. Just say it.
Well, look, you know, I suppose there's a chance you can make money, especially if you want to do it long haul. You know, Musk gets interesting ideas. You know, I can't say his stuff isn't interesting. It's not often practical, not often a read of the market, and I offer as exhibit one the Cybertruck.
Yeah, oh God, is that thing ugly?
It's about the ugliest damn thing I've ever seen. I see those and I go, what on earth prompted this person to buy it? I suppose some of it could strike gold. They've done interesting things with the rockets. I love the thing about catching the rocket back on the pad. That would be cool if it became practical. But you know, the point being, I suppose if I could take a little mad money and park it in there and I weren't so damn old and I was willing to sit on it for 30 years, it might turn into something interesting. But no, I'm not buying it now.
Well, the...
That'd just be pissing away money.
Dr. J, well, I mean, if it's that big of a bargain, you want to sell it the same day. You know, what I'm kind of going at here clumsily is if it's that hot, I'm not going to see it. And by the way, even though I'm not built that way, but if I was a regular broker, if it was that hot, I'm not giving it to you. But I would. But I mean, one day Dr. J and I were doing the show, we're on the score, right? So we're on live radio. The phone keeps ringing. So finally I go, "Jen, mute your mic and pick it up." There's some guy, there's an IPO coming out. And Jen, you know, he was more active on this stuff than I was, but he always tried to get into these IPOs. And when he was at DPM on the floor, he would go, instead of just using his regular DPM trade, you know, who knows how many, probably 100-some thousand shares of stock John would trade every day from his DPM. And so if you wanted, and you know, you have a stock firm that you use, or you might even had somebody in New York, you did it cheaply and effectively. You just gave somebody the hand signal, or you picked up the phone, you had a direct line. But if you decided to want to be in this game, you might actually do 20,000 shares a week at like Merrill Lynch or somebody or Morgan Stanley. That's how complicated this gets. And so that you become enough of a client that when the next hot one comes out, hot issue or whatever they call them, you might get 500 shares or 1,000 shares. Because everybody knows this is one of the most bizarre things on earth when you talk about, you know, you listen to congressional hearings all you want about people that are front running and everything. Nothing's more bizarre, Kevin, I don't know if you talk about this in your classes, when a company goes out for an initial public offering, which is an IPO, you hire a firm as a consultant to do the pricing for you. They tell you the price is $50. Oh man, $50 is a good number. Meanwhile, they're running around the country and telling all their people this thing's really worth 80. So if you're lucky enough to buy it at 50, you could puke it out the next day at 75, and not even so, because that's really the game. But then
don't hold it 2 days, or you're going to be screwed.
Well, yeah, it could be. So then
okay. So Chief, let me
Well, the bottom line is that I told John we've never gotten that call before. Tell the guy no, and sure enough, the thing went straight down after it came out.
Okay, dig this. Earliest date available for sale to the public market. Okay, this isn't the standoff agreement. It's really a lockup stuff, right? Restricted shares. I'm looking at this thing right now. I've got the S1 up. this is laughable nonsense. Okay, the second full trading day on the NASDAQ, immediately following the first earnings release date, up to 911.5 million shares of Class A common stock are released.
That's a lot.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are they talking about price?
Hold on. No. That's number one. Okay. That's the first line in this table. The next one. If the reported closing price of our Class A common stock on the NASDAQ is at least 30% greater than the public offering price for at least 5 of 10 consecutive trading days ending on and including the first earnings release date, the second full trading day after that is the unlock for another 455 million shares.
Good. When you say unlock, does that mean the insiders can start selling?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, normally, that's like a year.
Well, so basically, by the way, the NASDAQ changed the rules on when this thing could be, you know, could be listed in the first place, right? And so all kinds of other stuff, too. And then there's my God, that's just the first two. This table is here's another one. The 91st day after the date of the prospectus, 59 million. The 105th day, another 328 million. The 120th day, another 328 million. The 135th day, no other qualifications on these, just dates after the prospectus, another 328 million.
A lot of this must be insider stuff, and normally it's locked up for a long time. It's called
restricted. Well, yeah, the second full trading day immediately following the public release of quarterly financials for the quarter ending September 30th, 1.3 billion shares.
This is unbelievable.
Okay. I mean, this is, and oh, by the way, 180th day after the day of the prospectus, another 328 million. So, I mean, this is. And this table just keeps going and going and going and going. It's even
more bizarre that, and this is a conversation I've had with actually several of my clients lately. Let's say a guy like Kevin wants to be in the market and he doesn't want to pick a stock, which kind of is like me in that regard. He wants to buy the QQQs. Yeah, you know, yeah. His tech stocks are doing pretty good. Okay, so he buys the Qs. The Qs are trading 733. He just spent, maybe unbeknownst to him, and maybe not, because he was on the show a lot. Out of the 733, I'm going to say 330 of it is for six stocks. So if your stock is in the queues, and everybody who has a 401k or an IRA puts in 200 hours a week or whatever it is to the market, and they want to be in broad market indices, be it the S&P 500, be it the Q, whatever it is, they are routinely buying your stock along with the other, or those six stocks along with whatever. I think you didn't get down far enough in what you're reading that this thing is going to be included in the NASDAQ like almost immediately, which never happens. So 2 months from when this comes out, or 1 month, everybody who, Kevin O'Neill, who puts his 500 hours a month into his 401k plan with the university and has it going into QQQs, he's going to be spending $3 or $4 on Tesla stock without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
So how this works, and I'll be brief here, these are ETFs, but the stock is being held at Spider, SPY. They're all held at State, well, not all, but some of them are. A lot of the big ones are held at State Street Bank. They're the one who started this stuff. So what ends up happening is if you start buying options or that turn into stock, or you buy Spiders or you buy the Qs, there's a specialist in the Qs. Okay, so he sells you the Qs or the Spiders, and then he buys all the stocks that are in there. So if all of a sudden everybody's a buyer, okay, he's selling it to you, but he's going to get it rammed where the sun don't shine. If at his hedge, he could go buy options or something like that. But by and large, at some point, he's got to go get the stocks, okay, that match up at the exact ratio that they're in the S&P or the Qs. And then when he gets up to his neck in this, he turns around to State Street Bank and goes, here's the stock, give me the spiders or give me the Qs. And that's how they are created. The specialist essentially brings the stock to the bank and says, here's all the stock, give me the stuff. So now all of a sudden the guy, the stocks leave his account, go to State Street, go in the vault, and State Street issues him spiders or Qs. So every single time now, so I have some clients that have large positions in Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Google, and those kinds of things. And I go, and they say, well, should we sell it? And I say, well, what do you want to buy? Well, let's buy, the Qs. And I go, wait a minute. We're selling one, we're buying the other. I mean, it's not, if those are the stocks you have, you've essentially got 45% of the Qs. So, right. You're not getting anywhere. Well, you're getting somewhere. You're getting the other 50%. But if Tesla weasels their way in there and the market keeps going up, every single day people are buying Tesla and they don't even think they are. It's a massive advantage to be in one of these indices.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, that this actually goes in here at that particular point, that's like nuts.
Yeah, it's not. It's never happened. I don't think it's ever happened before.
No, it isn't.
What price are they talking about on this thing?
135.
Wow. And they figure it's going to trade. Well, part of this sort of makes sense. Kevin, I hope I'm not boring you with the details on this, but somehow Carl got me
wrong. After we roll over, we probably should talk about something where I can contribute. But keep going.
Well, I'm saying the reason why I started talking about the people who do the underlying. For a hot minute, they actually own all the stock. Between the time that they buy it from the issuing agent, being the company, or and the time you actually take buy it from them. They actually own it. So if, for instance, there's a reason why they're going to tell a company it's worth 50, they're going to tell you it's worth 60. Because if it comes out at 50 and the next trade's 45, it's on them. And that's not a good thing for Goldman Sachs. It happens, once a decade, Carl? And when it does, it's a bad day for those guys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so Kevin, you've absorbed some of this. What do you think? And where does it? Does it take?
Well, first of all, I try really, really hard not to think. That is
okay.
But every once in a while, it comes into play. I don't know what to tell you about it. I mean, I don't know what I can add to that. It's if people want to pay for it, cool. If people want to jump into the IPO, cool. Let them.
Well, I guess. How far off?
I don't care. He has every right to say I'm asking for money from a large the investment public, however you want to define the investment public, and if people want to pay the money, good for them. They but they're getting the risk with it, and they're getting I see upside, I see downside in any technology investment.
Well, how about commenting a little bit?
The concentration of the market, I think, is unhealthy, because creativity doesn't necessarily happen in the large corporations, and certainly not in I think Microsoft and even Apple stopped being really creative organizations a long time ago. You have those that are sort of the traditional tech ones. There's a lot of people investing in hardware. There's a lot of pushback on hardware right now and pushback on data centers. That's an interesting phenomenon, because computing capacity is important, and it's important in terms of economic development, and it's important in terms of even national security to a degree. But by the same token, and I think Carl's done a really nice job of documenting this, First of all, before I even get to that, we've discussed externalities and all of the impacts of that, and are we capable of doing it? We've also discussed, but Carl's also done a nice job of documenting the expense involved that people just don't realize that's involved in there. And I'm saying compute capacity. I'm not even calling it artificial intelligence. I'm just saying it's you know, the capacity to do large scale computing really or scale computing really fast. Where I think it is a little odd in the whole thing is what's behind all of the pushback. There is a certain amount of it that is absolutely local. It's like New Carlisle, Indiana, is put a stop to, and the St. Joe County with it, put a stop to a second data center right near the Amazon AWS data center that's in New Carlisle, because they're not liking how that's reshaping their community. And I think that's a really, really good, legitimate pushback. But by the same token, you have a lot of outside organization, including pushback coming from overseas, that is just trying to undermine computing growth in the United States because now we're getting into global competition on it, and there's so much you can do with social media to make it appear that there's a groundswell of pushback on it when there really, really isn't. So there's a whole dynamic in this whole area of hardware, data center growth, all of that, and I don't know how it's going to sort itself out. I think there's to a degree it's important, to a degree it's a drain, especially the early agreements that a lot of the data centers made in their communities have been terrible deals for the local communities. And I think some of the communities are getting a little smarter about that now too. So when you start talking about the tech stocks in general and where it's all going, I'm not sure. There's a whole bunch of shit going on here, and it's all going to have to sort itself out, and I'm not sure where it's going to go.
Well, Kevin, what do you make of, I know you, when you teach the supply side and all this stuff, it's obvious to everybody on the show, it's certainly obvious to me, you're very detail-oriented, and which is not a bad thing. But what Carl and I kind of just are glossing over here is these rules on the New York Stock Exchange, even on the NASDAQ, used to be very hard and vast and very specific on prospectus and red herring. And over the years, and for instance, when I got down here, you could not list a stock in the New York Stock Exchange that did not have voting rights. And now when Baidu came out, that thing is a goat cluster. I mean, it's the Jack Ma, who, I don't know if he's in jail or wherever he is, he owned all the property of Baidu, and the government could do something with that, and all you really bought, you had no voting rights, was I think the profits flowed through Bermuda, and that's what was actually listed on the, and all these rules just keep changing to the point where I wouldn't even, I just assume that the rules are the same, and it's my business. I don't sit there and go, wait a minute, they keep nudging outside what people think they're buying. And
just for clarity, I don't think it's the rules that are changing as much as it is the enforcement that's changing.
No. It had absolutely, for instance, what's Google is voting shares in one side and not voting on the other, right, Carl?
And
you could never do that before.
Well, and there's all sorts of stuff like that. The hair that's on this particular deal.
Just as a reminder,
Kyle, you dunked into the beer can. I can barely hear you.
Okay. Elon moved the corporation out of Delaware down to Texas to get away from the fiduciary responsibility requirements that you have to meet in order to be in Delaware. Texas doesn't have them.
Okay, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, well, that's the reason he moved it, because
I thought it was a tax thing of some kind.
No, they came at Chief. They can't remember. They came after him under that body of corporate law, which of course is very well developed. That's why pretty much everybody sticks public companies in Delaware. And it's not so much that the rules are, better, worse, whatever. It's that everyone knows what they are. All right. So it makes it pretty easy. Well, they came after him under his pay package, and said that this was destructive to the shareholders and therefore illegal. And won, in the Chancery Court. And then his response to that, he ultimately did beat that, by the way. However, his response to that was to move the corporation out of the state into Texas, because Texas doesn't have that in their corporate law.
Right. If you have a charter, I don't want to necessarily go down this road, but I want to ask Kevin one more question. On the Baidu situation, let's take that for just an example, Kevin. Well, now, stock has never really done as much as people thought it was going to. But, you know, it's been okay, I think. But now, Jack Ma was, where was he? In suspension somewhere because he pissed off the government. How many people even realize that they don't own anything? I mean, is it incumbent upon them to read it to be like Carl and like some of the other people on the show? Or is it incumbent upon that whole mess to be front and center, not buried in perspective that's 400 pages long that nobody's going to read? I mean, the communication, can the people who bought it and now realize they don't really own anything other than this, I think it's an income stream, which I think they're getting some income, so it's not like it's horrible, but whose responsibility is it when somebody goes, I don't know, I heard how good this Baidu is, I just want in. Now, I guess you could just say, you didn't read it, it's all on you, but how much did the New York Stock Exchange, you know, have, you know, I would say take out a back page of the newspaper and say, here's what the old rules are and here's what the new ones are. I mean, they're probably buried someplace, but I mean, I guess when you wobble in here, because one of you guys mentioned earlier about companies that, you know, the FASB thing, it was Carl talking about FASB. Well, in changing a lot of the bonus arrangements and things like that, well, the thing that I haven't talked about for a while on the show, and I don't know why we should talk about it, are these corporate boards sort of like Congress and the president, and not just this time, but it's been a thing, are these corporate boards really in charge when the guy who's in charge picks the board? And I think the answer to that has been no for 50 years, but yet somehow people think that it is, that somehow or another the board is going to say, no, Elon, $1 trillion is like a little too much. Why don't we pay a dividend first? But that's not going to happen because they wouldn't be there if that was the way they were going to vote. So there's all kinds of things sort of wrong here, but I guess the question to Kevin is, whose fault is it? Is it the people who realize it's like that, realize they're never going to give it in and buy the place anyway? I mean, is it them? Is it the company? Is the board member? Is it the SEC? Or is it a combination of a big blob of crap?
Well, I suppose you could try and regulate all of this right down to the penny. Never works. Ultimately, when we say, you know, do we expect people to read stuff? Yeah, I do. How much money are you willing to put down without reading it?
Well, everything you have. Everything you have.
And I'm not going to read a thing, and then you want me to feel sorry for me when it falls apart? Don't think so.
I'm with Kevin on this one.
If somebody came on CBC today and said, you wouldn't believe the incredible bubble that's happening in turtle eggs in Rwanda, you got to get into this, somebody will call. There's no idea if turtles lay eggs.
You're right, but here's the basic. I mean, when you look at what you got, just from that lockup section, okay? I mean, that was just like a quick scan, right?
That's astounding to me. That's incredible.
It's a page and a half, all right, of individual sets. I just sent the link to the list. So, if you want to look at some of the other, I mean, okay, this is in many ways, though, and I used to get these things all the time. I get the solicitations back when DLJ was still around during the 1990s, because that's where my trading account was at the time. You know, they're gone. How many people are going to read, 400, 500 page prospectus, right? Actually read the whole thing.
Well, that's okay? Why it's 400, 500 pages.
Well, yeah, not just the fluff components, right? But actually read it. And then, of course, the consolidated financial statements, to some extent, are projections to others. In this case, because SpaceX is actually an operating business and has been for quite a while, there's real numbers there.
Well, if you're just buying SpaceX, it might not be a bad idea.
Well, the problem is you're not.
Yeah.
The problem is all the hair that's rolled up in this thing. But Elon, whatever anybody that has followed anything that Elon has done throughout his entire life knows that this is how he structures things. He always has. It's not new.
The rules are for other people.
Well, okay, so, you know, we do solar roofs. That doesn't go anywhere. Well, guess what? How does that end up getting wound up into this, that, and the other thing? Okay, his X is now the tout board operated by the guy who has control of Tesla to tell everybody that you really need to be buying a car that has full self-driving, which, by the way, isn't actually full. So I can't get in the back of the car with a six-pack of beer and punch in, well, take me up to
censorship.
Take me up to the triple.
Censorship is such a horrible thing unless you're the censor.
Yeah, take me to the Tripoli tap, okay? I want to go have a drink with Chief after he gets off work. And I can't do that, okay? By the way, I'll be shit-faced when I get there because the car's driving itself. I don't have to actually be in the driving the car. These things are now the currency of the realm, if you will, in the alleged investment world. And I have absolutely no doubt that this offering will fully subscribe. I don't know where it will trade after it does. It is clearly how do I somehow manage to create enough hype around this thing that people believe that
if they get it in an index, they got half the battle won, I think. If the index keeps going up.
Except for one problem, Chief. The premise here is that the whole corpus of this thing is worth something in the order of $1.75 trillion.
Oh, yeah, that's kind of a lot.
Okay. I believe that about as much as I believe that NVIDIA has an actual corporate value of more than all but two nations on the planet. Okay, and
it's got to be way more than the whole Russell.
Well, by the way, if you go down, if you go down to about the seventh position, it's more than any two below that position in GDP.
Well, there is a combination. Yesterday we went through won't do it again, about it was with Russell. There's like seven different levels of the chessboard when you're talking about investing. Some people just love Elon Musk. Some people, any IPO that has any kind of pizzazz, they just want. Some people don't want any part of it. I mean, there's a momentum kind of trading. Nobody cares if a stock is going up. Look at Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Name out of all the people who own Bitcoin, how many people can explain to anybody what the hell it even is?
But by the way, how's that been working out for the last 6 months or so?
Didn't MicroStrategy had to sell something the other day to pay their preferred dividend, didn't they?
Bitcoin Jesus, who nothing is ever going to go wrong with that, right? By the way, less than a year ago, that stock was trading $4.57. Yesterday closed out at $1.29.
Yeah, now it's $1.26.
Ow!
What? Kevin, what is the? Do you get a lot of questions regarding cryptos in your classes and stuff? Or
Tom, I'm mostly teaching. I do teach blockchain in various classes, but I don't teach it from a cryptocurrency perspective. I'm saying, you all know blockchain. You've heard of blockchain because of cryptocurrencies, but as I have always told you, my interest is more from a supply chain perspective and supply chain transparency, because blockchain's really good for that. But for cryptocurrencies, I'm not that interested in them.
Well, I mean, the question was more pointed towards.
I own a little bit of Ethereum, just to and I'm talking hundreds of dollars, a couple hundred dollars worth, and I own that just because I said, okay, I want to see, I want to see what goes on with it. It was like buying a textbook, basically.
Well, do you get a sense of whether it's common among your students?
I haven't transacted anything in it in over a year, so that was just a dabble. But otherwise, I'm you know, I'm just not that interested in it, because the only thing I don't want to see happen is I don't want to see the federal government offer a cryptocurrency. Right. I don't want them to do anything with blockchain. It's none of their damn business. And that kind of, the same transparency that is valuable in a supply chain world in tracking movement of products is exactly what I don't want the government to have its hands on.
Well, the question was more of a, between the students and other teachers, do they talk about it? Are they involved? Do you have any idea? Do you have any sense of that?
No, but you know, half of my students are first generation college students who are, you know, who are eligible for Pell grants. So it's not going to be, you know, Russell might tell you something different, you know, if you ask him that same question, but that's not my student, you know, my target student.
Well, I'm sort of curious as I didn't used to see him, but once in a while now, I walk into a gas station for a cup of coffee, and I see a big Bitcoin machine there, and I wonder who the hell's buying it. Somebody must be. The machine costs a fortune. I have no idea. That's why I asked. I have no sense of who drops $100 in there, or whatever.
There's a few of them around here, but they're, you know, there's just not a lot of. Certainly, in the circles where I'm moving, there's just not a lot of activity in cryptocurrencies at all.
Okay, well. I don't know, what do you make of that, Carl? It seems like in some areas you talk to people and they all got a little chunk of it from somewhere. In other areas, they don't, like Kevin, it's not concentrated in some places, it is in somewhere else.
Well, okay.
I guess I'm trying to figure out if Bitcoin goes to 50,000, who gets hurt is where I'm going with this.
Well, my view of it is essentially... that this is digital tulips without the flowers.
Well, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, if it's 2 weeks from now or the next Labor Day and the three of us are back on here and Bitcoin's trading 40, which I'm not predicting, who's hurt? I mean, I'm always trying to figure out.
Well, who's hurt is number one, the person who holds it, right, obviously.
Yeah.
However, the bigger problem, and one of the things that the price of Bitcoin is fairly useful with, since it ended up with, you know, now you can trade it as a futures contract if you want to, right? It is now a forward leverage indicator. It's not a very strong, it's not a really strong one, but it's there, and it's one that you really kind of ought to pay attention to, especially when it starts doing what it's been doing lately. And I think this is a warning that tightening is occurring through the economy generally. You know, one of the things that you talk about and Hal talks about and is this whole thing with M2, right? And you know, you made a very interesting statement recently. That, well, as long as M2 is expanding, the market's going to go up, I got to be long. That's entirely too simplistic, Chief, and you know it.
Well, sure I do.
That's too cute by half, and a lot of people, if they actually try to use that as the indicator, are going to get their heads cut off, and I think the indicator, the red light is on at this point, okay? I precisely what's going to set it off, I don't know. When it happens 6 months later, I'll be able to look back and point at it and say, okay, you know, that was the thing, right?
But, well, the first of all, I agree with you that it's somewhat simplistic, but I also, if you look at the charts of the Weimar, the last day the currency kept going down, the market kept going up.
Okay, and Weimar was an externally imposed. Trying to generalize that situation to this, in my opinion, is extremely dangerous.
Well,
people are going to get badly hurt believing that stuff.
You know, Kevin, this is an example of it's not what you think you said is what people heard. What I said was left to its kind of own devices in the Fed and a lot of the investors when they say the Fed is always going to save me. Okay, they're telling me they believe that as long as them two, I'm trying to be this on two levels, which is hard to do when you have a conversation. And so the thing I sent you guys the other day was, okay, what is going to, where's the snafu that is going to cause this nirvana feeling that no matter what happens, and for God's sakes, guys, the last 4 years, it's a war and an endemic, a government shutdown, and the market's done nothing but go straight up. So it's easy to believe that the Fed is the savior here no matter what. So,
well, and it was in the 1990s, too.
Yeah, my question to you guys, because I think you guys are pretty bright, what should we be looking for that's going to cause that to somehow screw up, which means would be a sudden drop in the money supply. And my question with this conversation, I'm probably being awful at saying about it, could Bitcoin be that trigger?
Well, yeah, that's why I said, when you see the pattern you're seeing now, all right, look, divergences are not necessarily timing signals, okay? They aren't, because sometimes you get them and then what happened the last time after you got them doesn't happen. So yep. they don't make particularly great timing signals. However, they are warnings. When you have a sign, you go past a sign on the road at 3 o'clock in the morning, it says danger deer crossing. That doesn't necessarily mean that there is a deer around the corner. All right, and oh, by the way, you can't see it until it's too late, and you're gonna prang it right with your car. On the other hand, it does mean that in the past, somebody pranged a car at 3 o'clock in the morning because deer had this habit of jumping across the road in that particular point. So the same kind of thing is going on here now. And then within the broader general economy, I can tell you around here in this area, if you do not believe that there is a material slowdown, people's hours are getting cut, the amount of work that they have to do, even if they're not getting their hours cut, you know, the guy's picking up trash at the condos is hauling half as many bags as he normally does. Okay, now this time of year, this is you know, the spring and into this part of the summer. Now all the kids are out of school, so by God, there's no excuse, right? We're past Memorial Day, for Christ's sakes. And yet, yesterday, I went all the way into Pigeon Forge, which I normally would never think about doing on a Thursday afternoon.
Is that next to Hooterville?
Well, no, not really. But
what was the other one? Pixley? The big town was Pixley?
But I went, you know, I went to a bar that normally I would not go to on a Thursday afternoon because the traffic would be absolutely effing ridiculous, and where I am, I'm on the wrong side of it, right? So I'd have to traverse that.
Kevin, you think there was a happy hour there?
There were people there, but it wasn't packed full, and there was no traffic on the way down.
Okay, what I'm trying to lob in here, and because obviously this is what I do for a living, and Kevin's very interested, and you trade a lot too. The question is, for 20 some years, every time there's a market drop down, or maybe where it should drop down, it doesn't because the Fed reacts. Now the question is, what can overwhelm, surprise the Fed to the point where they can't do that? Now, is it Bitcoin? Is it big enough? Is it's worth $1.2 trillion? $1.5 trillion or $2 trillion is left in Bitcoin. What if, and this is, I'm not being political here, what if any president goes to the G7, say he wants to put Russia back in, they think he's a blithering idiot, and to do something to him, UK and Japan purposely don't show up for the next auction. I hope that doesn't happen. I don't think it's going to happen. Or what if Japan now, because they're back up to 160 on the yen, and they all of a sudden have to go buy some yen, which is what they do, and they sell some treasuries to do it. Is that a big enough shock to where the Lone Ranger, meaning the Fed's, not going to come over? I'm just trying to figure out here, what are the possible things that could happen, is all I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to make political statements or anything. What could, they've obviously very good at it. They've been doing it for 25 years. What could screw up to where they can't do it, is what I'm trying to find here.
Well, the dislocation And by the way, the market is totally ignoring this, which I think is Looniland. The dislocation that has come out of this adventure over with Iran and what has happened and is still happening with regards to the flow of primary energy and resources derived from it out of that part of the world is not going to be something that can be papered over, and you can't run credit to evade it. Behind every unit of GDP is a unit of energy. That is a physical fact. There's no way around it. The impact of this is, or it's been visible in the PPI. It was starting even before we went over there and did this.
Yeah, it was starting before that.
Yeah, I mean, we had a couple of months of run rate on it, but that I was flagging when the PPI reports were coming out before the war started. Okay, now you've added a multiplier effect onto that, and the market is paying exactly zero attention to any of it.
It's going up.
It's insane. There, that dislocation is absolutely in the system. It's in the Python. There's no way to avoid it. It's going to come out the other end, and there's only two things that can happen. It can either drive inflation to the moon, or it's going to whack operating margins. One of those two things is going to happen.
Well, now, are you shocked?
I don't know how either of those are good for the stock market.
Are you shocked after COVID?
No, I'm not surprised that it hasn't been recognized yet, but it hasn't come through the system. And by the way, the Fed has not done anything. Now remember, Congress, when COVID started, the first thing Congress did was throw gas on the fire.
Yep.
Okay? Congress hasn't thrown a nickel's worth of gas out this time.
Well, they sort of have. Look at the money they're spending on all the defense stuff and everything.
No, they're not.
Well, I mean...
The size of the emergency allocations in the first couple of months of 2020, my God.
Well, you're right. I mean, I'm not. Well, they sent everybody checks, for God's sake, right?
Well, yeah. Hello.
Yeah.
All right, I got one.
Yeah.
I mean, that kind of thing isn't happening.
No.
All right, at all. So I.
Well, how is the.
I'll just throw in, because you know this is basically it's the way any system behaves. We've had the shift in supply on of like you said, the basic energy stuff, and there's been some reaction to it. There's been some reaction. You know, I think the United States is up to pumping like 13.5 million, whatever the number is, barrels a day. It's not billion, but 13.5 million barrels a day. So there's some adapting and finding a new equilibrium. What's going to happen if, let's just say, it gets solved in the next week, that we get some kind of deal, we start the oil flowing out of the Gulf again. Everybody's got to, there's got to be some production ramp up. There's a whole bunch of things. So now we're looking a couple more months down the road, and we're starting to see how we've adapted to all of that. And this is, I've mentioned a couple of times on the show the notion of demand amplification, but it's really this idea that every time, the system starts to find some kind of equilibrium, some kind of saying, okay, in the current situation, things have sort of settled in, and this is the way the routine looks, and now all of a sudden we're going to change it again, and we're going to take a wild swing, because we're not going to go to some kind of equilibrium. We're going to go to some extreme type of swing before finding a way back. And this is going to be just a really, really crazy year built around just energy changes, let alone anything else political, let alone anything else economical. And at the same time, you have Kevin Warsh, who's been saying for years now that he doesn't think the Fed's job should be to bail out Wall Street anymore. Well, I don't know if he can implement that or not, but if he starts to do anything for that, that's going to start shocking the system as well. And all in all, it's, we're in a time, an incredibly unpredictable time in terms of just system behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I agree. And look, most chief, You're a little older than I am, but we're in more or less the same sort of age cohort. Okay.
Funny how that happens when you get old, right?
Yeah, isn't it funny how that...
If you were 16, you never thought you were the same age as somebody 18.
Well, you know, it kind of is what it is, right?
Yep.
But here's the thing, and this I think is very important, because I was talking to some people about this a few days ago. If you're under 60, realistically, okay, and certainly under 55, you have no adult operating memory of 1974 and what it led to. I came of age and went into the workforce right after, on the tail end of the suck, if you will.
Yeah.
All right. And the suck was bad. And the suck was engendered. And I remember sitting in gas lines where you could only...
Actually, when was the first one? 71 or 72?
Yeah, but I mean, it was, yeah. You know, you could only buy gas on even days if the last number of your license plate was an even number. Right?
If you saw the not even rationing, I remember 10 gallon rationing.
5 gallon limits.
Yeah.
Well, okay. If you saw a station open, you pulled in line.
Well, and the line and the line was half a mile long.
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I remember this. This is not a, you know. Yeah, okay. I wasn't driving yet when it started. I was you know, riding in the back seat or riding in the passenger seat. This was before, you know. Oh, every kid has to go.
Carl, it was just for the listeners and her. I should remember there were two of these. There was the Yom Kippur War, and what was the other one? Was there some? There were two times that we got cut off. What was the one? Was
the 1974 embargo was the more serious of the two, and it went on for 5 months, and the bad effects from it went on for 8 years.
Oh yeah, but what was the one earlier? Yeah, 71.
Let me tell you a quick story about that, because I know you're going to have to take a break and get to the jobs report. For that particular that war, I do remember. I wish I had it. You know, but the South Bend Tribune ran a headline that Sunday morning, and the big bold front page headline had the Irish defeating Michigan State by whatever the score was, and then there was this little note in a column on the right that says war breaks out in the Middle East.
you got to know your clientele.
You know, I don't know which one turned out to be more significant. It might have been the football score. But I think the war that led to the oil embargo was probably a little more significant from a headline standpoint.
Yeah, the first one didn't last much. Was the first one the Yom Kippur War? There was one. Or when was OPEC founded? That was like the first time.
Well, OPEC was around, yeah.
But the cutoff was in 1974, though, and it was 5 months.
Yeah, but something happened before that, because I was earlier in college when the first one happened. It wasn't very long, but it was some where the gas prices went from like 40 cents to a buck the first time, and everybody freaked out. What's the cheapest you ever bought gas?
Oh, God.
About 27 cents for me.
What was that, Kevin? How much?
At least 27 cents, I think, would be about the low.
I remember 29.9, but I wasn't buying it. I was in the car, though.
I was. I think most of the time it was like what Kevin's talking. One day there was a big gas war. I remember the place, 71st and Damon,
19.9. Well, yeah. I mean, those were the days when you could borrow mom's car on Friday, and go out, put a dollar's worth of gas in, and return it with more gas than when you left.
Remember, leave it to Beaver, and Lumpy pulled in. Give me a quarter's worth of the finest.
Yes.
we got to go to break here, and we're going to get to these numbers.
I'm going to listen to your comments about the jobs report.
So. All right, real quick break. SP Futures down 40, NASDAQ is down 360. These numbers better be good, whichever good means. We'll be right back.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Hello, Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm talking about Ricky on the board. You're right, it was October 6, 1973. The coalition of Arab states led by Egypt and Syria attacked Israel and the oil weapon. That's when it all started. It lasted until March of 1974. You are correct. Real quick, because all these numbers are going to change. S&P futures down 42, and NASDAQ futures down 381. I'll just give the gold number here. The gold's down $6. We got oil down 35 cents. We have bonds unchanged at 4.48. Foreign exchange. Yen is at hit 160. I don't know if they intervened because it's now 150.99. We'll talk about that for a second. But these numbers, are they out, Colonel?
I'm waiting for the page to refresh. They are.
Yep, I got it too.
Does not look like they're having much impact on the futures initially. All right, here we go. Plus 172 unemployment rate unch. Let me pick the numbers up, and you can talk about traffic, weather, whatever.
Yeah, Ricky, why don't you do a real quick Cubs with a big save last night. I fell asleep watching them.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:31 a.m. here in Chicago. It's 71 degrees right now with a high of 77. Variable clouds, breezy and not as warm with a few showers and some humidity this afternoon. Tonight will be cloudy, warm, and humid with a couple of thunderstorms with potential of hail and a low of 68 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 83 degrees right now with a high of 108. Hot with plenty of sunshine. Elevated risk of wildfire due to wind gusts, low humidity, and dry brush. Tonight, clear and warm with a low of 80 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Montrose is 13 minutes. 26 minutes, Iman Edens from Lake Cook. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf is also 26 minutes. Then Ryan from 95th, 23 minutes. Stevenson from 24, 30 minutes. Let's do sports super quick. Cubs beat Athletics 7-6 and Diamondbacks beat Dodgers 3-2. Today we got Giants coming to Wrigley Field at 1:20 p.m. White Sox at Phillies at 5:40 p.m. and Diamondbacks and Nationals at Diamondbacks at 8:40 p.m. For the NHL, yesterday Hurricanes turned back in overtime and beat the Knights 4-3 in Game 2. Series is now tied 1-1. Game 3 is tomorrow at 7 p.m. in Las Vegas. And for the NBA, today we have Game 2 of NBA Finals. Knicks at Spurs at 7:30 p.m. New York with the lead 1-0. Back to you, Chief.
Go ahead, Carl.
All right, I got some numbers here because I got the
Spurs around 46, so then. They don't like them because they're good numbers, right?
Well, they're not really all that good. Leisure hospitality up 70 in May. That's not surprising. I mean, it's, you know, summer, right? Food service and drinking places plus 48. We'll see how long those people stay employed. If the indications I have from around here have any accuracy, that's not going to be very long. Healthcare is pretty much where it has been, plus 35, which is... I mean, that's in terms of Delta, that's an unch for all intents and purposes. Financial services down 22,000. Transportation, warehousing, essentially unch. And we've got average work week. This says is unch for everybody. It says that overtime edged up a touch. I need to go look at the internals on that because that's, as I've pointed out a bunch of times, employers tend to change hours before they change hiring or lay people off simply because there's costs involved in doing the other. You have to train people and stuff like that. If you cut somebody's hours, you do that before you'd fire them. And when you run out of room there, that's when the firing starts. So, but the unadjusted numbers, which of course is what I pay a lot of attention to, plus 116 on the headline as far as number employed. The 12-month run rate, which is still deeply negative, has improved from where it was last month. But it's still -1.873, which is, it's horrible. It was -3 million last month, so that's is what it is. Employment.
Are you showing the employment amount of the percentage of people employed? I got it up a ticking up one. Do you?
I'm flat on that. Employment population ratio is 59.2, and it was last month as well.
These guys hit it at 59.1 last month. Well, I say these guys, the adjusted table.
Yeah, the adjusted table. The sitting on your butt number was down 153,000.
These guys got it up 17.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's again, I don't work off that, but I don't see, the basic blush, you know, first blush take here without digging into the internals yet, and I'll do that as we keep talking, is that this is it's not weak. If you're expecting the Fed to cut rates into weakness in the labor force and the labor market, there's certainly nothing that indicates that anybody ought to be thinking about that. On the other hand, if you're thinking the labor force, you know, the labor market is overheating and the Fed needs to raise rates, you don't got that either.
No, it has nothing to do with the labor market. It has to do with the inflation. But
no, I get that. But I'm saying that I don't see the markers, the employment population ratios across the educational attainment. Just looking at that right now, there's some movement, but not a lot. One thing though that is somewhat of a problem, and I've talked about this for an awfully long time. This pattern continues. In that you are seeing issues here with regards to the downshift of educational attainment, and the barbell used to be that if you're in the middle, you basically were hosed, right? So if you want, if your job was a janitor and paid, you know, $12 an hour, you know, you probably had a job. If you had a bachelor's degree or better, you had a job. If you're in the middle somewhere, you had trouble. Okay, and bad things were coming. That barbell now is being lost, in that you're not seeing the certainty. Well, just as an example, over the last year, the employment population ratio among and participation rate among people with a bachelor's degree is down substantially over the last 12 months. Okay.
Well, all the people that are being laid off around here for like exchanges and FINRA and people like that, all have bachelor's degrees.
Well, and the other thing is the same pattern is there in people that have an associate's or some college. So people who do not have a bachelor's but have been to, you know, have post-secondary education.
Where or when does, when you see, you know, Bezos or these guys coming out saying we're laying off like 5,000 people, is that over the next 6 months? What if somebody gets laid off, because a lot of these people did get laid off by the CBO. What if you laid off and you, I might have asked you this before, but maybe some of the listeners weren't listening then that are now. Somebody gets laid off after being at a place for 30 years and they get 30-week severance and they stay and they also get the hospitalization. When are they officially gone and when can they apply for unemployment?
Well, when your employment ends, I mean, so if you're, if you're getting paid for 3 months before then, I would assume that, you know, you can't get unemployment because you're still drawing a check.
These guys were telling people to go and apply.
Well, yeah, but it takes time to get it, right? I mean, my daughter went through a bunch of BS during COVID with the state of Florida that was jacking around with actually processing stuff. She did ultimately get the money. Thank God she had, you know, some savings and was able to pay rent and buy groceries in the interim. But, I mean, she was owed the money. She, you know, the place she worked for was forced closed. It wasn't that she didn't quit.
Well, I mean, some of these packages, I mean, I'm not... Well, some of these guys are, you know, some of the places, especially exchanges, because they got a lot of money. They're like right. The government, for God's sake. If their policy is 2 weeks a year and somebody's been there 25 years, well, that's a year. Do they stay on the active payroll, or do they just cut them a check for the amount, or do they?
I think that's situationally specific, and I don't know, you know, what happens in each case. Interestingly enough, there's, all right, so...
Well, the other question is, the person must do something. Why do you want to pay them for a year? Even if you don't think that that's the future, is their job, why not, you could have them sweep the floor for a year. It's better than send them a check at home, isn't it?
Well, you'd think. I mean, you know, on the other hand, when my company got acquired, I was formally on the payroll as a consultant for 3 months, and I Hell, I could have watched porn all day in terms of the amount of actual work I did for the guys that acquired me. I mean, I was there if they needed anything or they wanted something, but as it turned out, it was more of a formality than actually doing integration work for these guys. By the way...
Say, don't you realize how lucky you are? Because now you can sit there and do nothing all day and be busy.
Well,
when I started at Pullman, you had a phone on your desk.
Well,
that was it.
Well, I get it. By the way,
not an iPhone. It was the phone.
Yeah, phone. Yeah. Right, exactly. Well, here's an interesting thing. All these hires in leisure and hospitality—they're getting hammered on hours. And the reason I know this is because while the hourly earnings have gone up, the weekly checks are actually down about $1. Now, you hired a whole bunch of people. How busy are they? Not so good. Not so good. That correlates with what I'm seeing on the ground. So, I mean, interestingly, the index of aggregate weekly payrolls. Some of these data points don't correlate, and they should. All right, which that bothers me. That's a bother. Okay, just saying.
When you see these big announcements, I mean, I know there's no way you can rattle off the answer to this question, but when you see, what was it a couple of weeks ago? They're laying off like 10,000 people. Where hell are they? Are they in India? Are they here?
So here's the game that's been played, and this is starting to get noticed now. Among social media in particular, and it won't be long before this gets picked up as the squeeze really starts to tighten on people from this stuff with the energy side of things. You have a repeated pattern where company A lays off 6,000 people, and they're here, here in America, right? And immediately hires 4,000 or 5,000 in India. Well, that's illegal. All right.
Now, when you say, walk me through this, because I talk to people on the phone. They're obviously not from here, so I'm sort of with you at that. But if let's say PTI had a 50-person IT department, and we had people working, we actually took calls from people, which we do, by the way, because people make trades. But we answer the phone. I'm just a schmuck. I got 50 people here in my IT department. Right. They all look at me. Who approaches me? Who says, "Hey, I know they call you the chief, but you don't know anything about this, you idiot. If you could fire all those 50 people, and I'll do all the same work in India." Who's that guy? Do I hear about it from somebody else, how much money he's saving, and I do this myself, or do people approach me? Do I go to the Indian consulate? What do I do? How do I get 40 people doing my stuff over in India?
To a large degree, that's not what's going on. To a large degree, what's going on is that you're bringing these people in on H-1Bs.
Well, I don't want to say whose firm it is, when this group that was writing all the software for a really high-end online brokerage firm, those people were all in India.
Oh, yeah. No, well, if you can do that, it people do that.
But how do you find them? Or do they find you? Or?
There are a substantial number of firms that's what they do.
They'll do that for you.
And I get spam solicitations all the time. For web application development, things like I'm not buying any of that sort of thing, but I get those kinds of and a decent number of them are companies that have representation here in the United States, and their reason for existence is offshoring labor to people. And the truth is, the quality is not very good, but the price is so cheap that nobody really cares. And That's a huge problem, Chief, especially when you turn around and you tell 18-year-old kids to go get a STEM degree, go learn how to do computer engineering, and then they come out of school and they're competing with a guy that's making 20 grand a year in India because he has no debt. Yep. And by the way, he craps in the middle of the street, so he has a very low cost of living compared to us, too. Okay, now how do, now, you know, the wage and environmental arbitrage has been one of my hot button issues forever.
I know it has. I have a little story for the reason why I ask this question. I always ask a question for kind of a, well, a reason, hopefully. Well, I used to belong to the Economic Club of Chicago. Jim Tyree, good friend from Mez Road, one of the greatest guys I've ever come across. So he dies young, right? So I didn't have anybody to go with, so I stopped going. Anyway, so we always had to wear tux, and someone would give a speech. And but whenever you got there, they always had, you know, four or five bars set up, but there maybe only were like 15, 20 of those little like cocktail tables. They stand high. You're supposed to stand there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the thing of it is, I was never comfortable just standing there holding. So I would get there early, knowing that if you want to talk to somebody and learn something, the first thing you do is sit, put your drink down at one of those tables and stand there. Because everybody else is going to want a spot to put theirs down, and within a minute, there's going to be somebody next to you that's obviously an Economic Club of Chicago, somebody you want to talk to, right? I mean,
right.
I mean, so one day, just, well, not that I noticed, very attractive lady comes by, and she says, you know, she's with the Chinese consulate.
Oh.
And I get her talking to her, and I, you know, Jan and I were on the score at the time, and I said, boy, I wouldn't mind having you on the air one day. Well, we only had a half hour. Then we went to 1 hour show, but we didn't have much time. And she's talking about the here's where the thing is. And I said, what if somebody wanted to, you know, all of a sudden, we had just had a guest on who made coatings, don't call them Teflon, for frying pans.
Right.
And he was in West Chicago somewhere, but he had to open up a place in China because all the guys who made the pots and pans were starting to do it in China. Well, you can't do the coatings here if the pot and pan's over there, right? So,
right.
So the guy, he was on, and so I said, this lady, I said, you know, what's the procedure if I wanted to hook this guy up, or somebody like him up, because I didn't tell her about the guy. So she gives me her card, and she says, well, if somebody really needs to do that, come to us, we'll hook them up, we'll find out what kind of industry they're talking about, what kind of plant they need, we'll hook them up with somebody from China, meaning like from the government, right?
Right.
It's going to be like their guy. To find him the spot,
yeah.
Make sure nobody demands a raise ever, you know, whatever else they do, and so at least in that regard, there
and by
was.
By the way, we got a 50-story building we could throw you off if you do.
Yeah. And so I mean, so there was some sort of a procedure where you would get help from somebody. I'm just wondering, I mean, how does somebody, you know, land a call center in the Philippines? There must be somebody that once you reach a certain, they must be like calling on Commonwealth Edison to say. You know, we'll do your calls from the Philippines, and we're excellent.
Oh, Chief, there's plenty of lobbying that goes on.
Oh, there is? Okay. That's a world that I'm, that's why I'm asking the question.
Oh, yeah.
That's
yeah.
a world I have no knowledge of.
No, I have some, and it's a group of people that, as far as I'm concerned, I have very good use for industrial quality plastics chippers for every last one of those individuals, because as far as I'm concerned, what they're doing ought to be considered treason.
Yeah.
It isn't in today's world, but it should be. Let me give you just one piece of information here out of table A7. This is in the BLS.
Well, hey, before you do that, the one yeah. I'm looking at, the dummy one,
right.
pretty much shows a very benign, very nice month. It has the people working up 150. This is the adjusted household survey.
It has the
participation rate up a tick, which doesn't sound great, but it's better than down. It has the right. people unemployed looking for a job. Down 70,000, and it's got the amount of people that we don't know what they're doing only up 20. So the combination of those two columns has you down 50 there, and you got 150 working. So it doesn't look bad at all, really.
No, it's neither hot enough to provoke provoke a reaction, nor cold enough to provoke a reaction. Right? Nobody's getting frostbit, and nobody's broiling to death. Yeah, I mean, that's the first blush from the top-level read. Okay.
Look at what it's done to the interest rate. So you see this? We got 10 years blown through 45 like dinner through a goose, 4.53.
Yeah, you know, there's
and 30 years over 5.
Well, you got, yeah, the TNX certainly had a reaction to that, didn't it?
Yep.
That's rather interesting, and that's a lot of steepening because the IRX did not move much.
That's almost 1.5%. That's a lot.
That's a big move. Yeah, it is. That's pretty substantial. Here's the curve steepening is an inflationary signal. Right. Employment population ratio, foreign born, 16 years over. This is table A7. This is over the last 12 months. You don't have month by month on this. They only give it to you a 12 month basis. Employment population ratio went from 63.7 for foreign born to 64.1. Okay, so that's positive, right? That's a positive change. Native born, 16 years and older. Employment population ratio, 58.9 to 58.2.
That's a lot down.
Yeah. This has to stop, Chief.
How do we get people...
These people have to be ejected. I don't care if people like it or not.
But, Carl, you look at this from one way.
Chief, 31.579 million foreigners in this country that are taking jobs that Americans can have.
That's one issue, okay? It's not like I know a gazillion people. Every person I know, and a lot of them, not a lot, but some on the show, all have families, all know a lot of people. They can all name you 2, 3, 4 people in their family or friends that have somebody, a kid, a brother, or somebody that's never had a job, lives in somebody's basement. No matter, you could say $500 an hour to be a carpenter tomorrow. They would have no more interest than the man in the moon. What is wrong with us? I mean, here.
Well, lots, Chief. But yeah. You know what? Where this started, okay, and you're old enough to remember it, and so am I. Where this started was Americans won't pick strawberries. The truth is Americans won't pick strawberries for $4 a day.
Well,
They also won't hot rack in tourist areas with 18 people in what used to be a flea bag hotel room.
I think it's somewhat deeper than that, Carl.
This is all economic driven. It's not driven by anything else. This is all driven by employment cost. And people who think it's not, you're wrong. It is. The easiest way to solve this in the skilled, this started with agricultural stuff, okay? But it didn't stay there. And the problem with not stepping on it when it was in the agricultural area is now it is in jobs that formally, supposedly require degrees in technology and things like this. And they just busted a group of people over in India, 100,000 fake medical and technology degrees, engineering. These are people who are doctors, supposedly.
I don't think...
But the degree was false. And guess what? If you think... When you see somebody gets caught selling heroin on the street corner down by your shop. That's not the only guy selling drugs.
There's a huge difference, and this is no point in arguing about it because we'll just discuss it. We only have a few minutes. There's a huge difference. Me being from, being with in this blue collar area that has gone sour, and the economic view of the world that you're espousing. If you just pay people enough, they'll do something. It's not really the way it... When I first started the show, when was the big recession? 2009 or whatever? We just sort of started it. Or actually, I knew Matty Weber from Around the Score. His friends all graduated college about that time, and everybody got laid off. They're all in marketing and whatever stuff. And I was, a little more sprightly. I wasn't going to be doing the ceilings, but I said, Matty, I know enough people... You got 2, 3 of your friends. Nobody's working. What do you say? I go find us every weekend. We'll paint a house. I'll teach you guys how to do it. I mean, it won't take me long to teach you. I'm pretty good at it. I'm not great, but I'm pretty good at it. Well, we don't want any part of that. Well, what do you mean? It's like a job. My guys aren't painters. Well, they will be after 2 days.
Right after 2 days of training.
Two days of training. They had zero interest.
Okay, zero. Well, how are they managing to do that?
Parents. I don't know. Maddie's parents weren't sending them. They're on unemployment. They're on something.
Okay, Chief. That's now you're starting to get towards the root of the problem. Okay. If I don't, there is a. And you know, Hal talks about this stuff some. Kevin talks about this stuff too. There is a point where people say, you're going to give me EBT and Section 8 and what, or however it happens, whether it's formally through government programs or whether it's informally, there is an economic singularity issue that comes up where if I can't eat for real,
yeah, but I know
my motivation changes.
I can't argue what you're saying, but my point is, in the Chicago area, and I used to have an ally until he passed, unfortunately. By the way, Bill Moriarty, who used to be on the show, passed of cancer. Next Saturday, I'm going to his funeral here in Chicago. Yeah, Bill's one of my best friends, one of the nicest men I've ever met, and one of the funniest guys, but very bright. I don't know when the show was, but I had a long conversation with him. It was after you and I had one of these discussions. And I said, you know, Bill, there's a guy on the show that keeps talking about, you know, people doing these jobs and bringing people in from over. And he said, you know, in the business that he was in, water treatment plants, those kinds of things, he said, our best workers were people that came in from Mexico. He goes, I said, you know, Carl and I go back and forth about this. And he goes, well, your friend Carl doesn't appear to have any idea of what it was like growing up on the south side of Chicago, where all these people, there were a few people that had college degrees, my stepfather did, worked in these essentially blue-collar jobs, high-end people, welders, you know, engineers, those kinds of things, because every one of those places is gone, and every one of them screwed these people, and every father made a thing to himself and said, I'm never going to let my kids get involved in these kinds of industries, because all of a sudden they're overseas and everybody's out and you're 40 years old with no other skill set. They would never let them happen.
By the way, I grew up in exactly that. I grew up near the Motor City. What the hell do you think I saw happen with the UAW?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the
Trenton was such a huge amount of them. Not just one industry. It was
But I'm saying, like, the entire industrial, for crying out loud, I had a steel mill that was across the river from me.
But every family. Why do you think people demanded people go to school? So this won't happen to you. But now it is.
But now it is.
Yeah.
And again, my point is that we didn't stomp on it when it happened in the other places. Because it's just those guys.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
I got into it with some people in the pub the other night. They were, because I was going after Elon and this garbage that he pulled. Because data centers is a hot topic everywhere now, right? With what's going on with them building them, wanting to put one up in everybody's backyard. And I said, there's a serious problem here. Elon wanted to put this huge thing that he calls Colossus, which is basically his training thing for all of his AI crap, outside Memphis. Problem was, he couldn't get the power. It just wasn't available for what he wanted. So rather than pay the power company to build the infrastructure, that would be the intelligent, you'd think, thing to do, right? No. That's not what he did. He went across the river because they wouldn't let him do it in Tennessee. So he went across the river in Mississippi and bought a bunch of what amount to jet engines.
You're talking the Tennessee River, not the Mississippi River.
Across from Memphis into Mississippi.
All right.
Okay. Stuck a bunch of what amount to old jet engines where their hot sections are old enough that they can't be used in airplanes anymore. There's a crap ton of those laying all over the place because, they wear out, right? There's nothing wrong with using them on the ground except they don't meet emission standards and they're illegal to use for prime power generation. It's against the law. They are explicitly not allowed to be used for that purpose.
What happens with the
Chief, he put them in anyway.
All right, but every time you say, I know I shouldn't do this, but every time you say something, it brings me another question. The CBOE, which has now been sold to a data center place, they have a huge generator on the roof. Essentially, it's a locomotive without wheels.
Yeah.
Now, right. It was supposed to be used for really hot days when Commonwealth Edison called them and said, would you mind turning it on? Are they going to be able to use that 24/7?
No.
I bet they're planning on it.
Well, the law is that back... So the reason you, for example, at your house, if your power goes out frequently, you can call up a place and have them put a Generac or a, there's three or four different... Kohler makes one as well that goes outside your house and hooks into your natural gas line, or if you're on propane, your propane line, and it you know, keeps your house going when the power's off, okay? There's no catalytic converter on that engine. There is on your car,
yep. But
there isn't one on this, just like there isn't one on your lawnmower. And that's legal because it's only for standby backup purposes. So there are different rules depending on the purpose. If you want, the other thing is, you would, if you could get combined cycle gas turbines, you would, because they're twice as efficient. They run what's called Brayton and Rankin as a combined cycle. It's about 60% efficient. A straight turbine generator is about 30%.
So you're saying a SIBO building probably can't use it, but nobody from this city is going to show up and say to turn it off.
Well, okay, so Elon puts this thing in. Puts a whole bank of these things in to get his power and runs a wire across the river to his data center.
Hopefully the wire isn't like neck high.
Well, no, I suspect not. Otherwise, you know, yeah. Hello, yeah. So anyway, the bottom line on this though is that the pollution, both the noise, jet engines are a little on the loud side, right? So, essentially, that's what these things are. Is a jet engine with a generator and coupled to them. He powers these things up on a full-time basis, which is wildly illegal under federal law, EPA regulations.
I think Elon uses every law to him as a workaround, as they used to say.
And by the way, he's screwing everybody in Memphis because the wind blows all the emissions and everything into town. Right across the river. So it's not just the people on the other side of the river that get screwed, it's also the people in Memphis. And I actually had somebody tell me, oh, it's just those guys. Basically saying, oh, well, they're black, so they don't matter.
We got a dash, but you have no idea how much I know, because we lived my first house when I was a little, you know, an infant to maybe three, was in back of the yards. The stack yards ended at 47th Street, and we were 50th.
Yeah.
Well, we were south. And maybe a little.
So you had a power plant right there.
Well, some kind of power plant. We had that's where all the cattle were.
That too. Yeah.
So, but most of the time, the wind would come from like the west, the west or southwest. But once in a while, it didn't. Boy, what a difference!
Yeah, when it didn't, you got it.
I think the tanning factories and the what do they call the place where you boil all down all the. What do they call it? The rendering plants?
Oh, the rendering plants.
They stunk more than the cattle, I think. But God.
Yeah.
Anyway, SP Futures down. What do you make of this? Down 53. NASDAQ Futures down 43. 433.
You got no blowout either direction. So now the market gets to trade without the Fed coming
in. It's down 1.5%. The NASDAQ. That's a lot.
Well, it's just starting, Chief. Starting.
All right, then. We'll talk to you on Tuesday, bud. Have a good weekend. Ricky, job as usual. Back on Monday, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.